Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. The murder of three American consular employees in broad daylight focused the world's attention on Juarez. In fact, Juarez, just 300 miles from Albuquerque and 50 miles from Las Cruces, is now the world's most dangerous city, about 8 to 10 murders a day. In response to this violence, Governor Richardson called out the New Mexico National Guard, and Arizona just passed anti-immigrant legislation. Joining us to discuss what's behind the violence and how we should respond is Monica Ortiz Uribe, a reporter based in El Paso, Juarez, who can be heard on NPR's Latino USA, and Rebecca Jasso Aguilar, whose doctoral work at UNM looks at contemporary political movements in Mexico. Monica Ortiz Uribe, Rebecca Jasso Aguilar, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me here.
Monica, I'd like to start with you and just ask you what the situation is really like in Juarez. You know, on the one hand, we hear 2,000 murders last year, some of them very gruesome. People are having their heads cut off, their hands cut off, horrible killings. On the other hand, I have a friend who is from Juarez, who goes down there all the time, says he's never had a problem, he's never seen a problem, although even he admits that he would prefer not to spend the night in Juarez. So what's the situation like in Juarez as you see it?
Well, Juarez is going through one of the worst moments in its 350-year history. There hasn't been this much death and violence since the Mexican Revolution 100 years ago. People are being murdered on a daily basis. You mentioned last year. Last year was actually about 2,600 murders.
Oh.
And this year, it's more than 700 so far. So it's looking to surpass even last year's numbers. So it's progressively growing worse. And, the murders are mostly done by gunfire. People are shot at very close range multiple times. And these are occurring during the day, at night, in the morning, in front of schools, shopping centers, neighborhoods. Alongside the murders and the shootings, there's also kidnapping and extortion that's going on pretty heavily. So again, the city is in really, really bad shape, the worst it's seen in 100 years. Now, on the other side of things, you mentioned your friend that goes to Juarez. He hasn't seen anything. He's been okay so far. Despite everything I've just said, I can luckily say the same thing. When I drive into Juarez, it's at the beginning, it's like any other big border city in Mexico. There's traffic on the streets. There are businesses operating. People are going to work, to school. The biggest difference is when you start to realize that this is not any normal Mexican city is when you see the armed convoys of military and federal police zooming up and down the streets. I feel very fortunate that I myself haven't witnessed anything, any shootings, killings, kidnappings or extortions personally, but I have definitely spoken to dozens upon dozens of people that have experienced that and live with a lot of anxiety.
Rebecca, let me bring you into the conversation, because from my reading, what I understand is that about 10 years ago, the violence in Juarez and actually throughout Mexico began to increase as cocaine traffic was really cut off through the Florida routes. It began coming in through the Mexican routes. There began to be a lot of inter-cartel violence. Then we have Calderon running on a sort of law and order platform, but the result of his increased aggressiveness toward the cartels hasn't been to tamp down the violence. It seems to be to increase the violence. So I'm wondering, first of all, do you agree with that sort of summary? And second of all, can you help us better understand the dynamics of what's been happening say since 2006 when Calderon took office?
Well, since Calderon took office, there's been 20, I think the number I read was 22,000.
Yeah, that's the number I saw. Killings.
Killings all over Mexico, not just Juarez. And the violence that Monica described in Juarez could be said of almost all of Mexico, although it's been localized, of course, to Chihuahua, then other states like Sinaloa, Nuevo León, Michoacán. And Monica, if you want to, say something at any point to add or to complement what I say, please do that. So the violence has happened in all the country. Now, what you're saying is true. These 3 years have not proved anything positive. Trafficking has not decreased. Consumption has not decreased, not in Mexico, not in the United States. So a lot of people are questioning, what is the point of continuing on this with this strategy?
And what exactly is the strategy? What is it that Calderon did?
Well, what Calderon did was get the army out on the street. I mean, when he ran his presidential campaign, one of his main things was mano dura. I don't know if you understand that, like hard hand.
I do. Yes, I do understand.
Right.
My Spanish is bad, but that's probably the limit of it.
I'm going to crack down on everything, mm-hmm. on delinquency, on narcotrafficking, on everything, and of course on social movements. Do anything that would seem like disturbing the order.
This is sort of a Giuliani-like response, except in Mexico.
Well, that's what he said.
It's also important to point out that the current all the violence is due to the best way to describe it is a twofold fight. Yes, it's Calderon that initiated this fight against corruption and against the drug cartels 4 years ago when he went into office. It was among the first things that he did. So there's that. There's the government fighting against organized crime and corruption. And then at the same time, you have organized crime, the drug cartels fighting amongst each other. And that's why Juarez is the way it is right now. There are two different drug cartels that are fighting for that territory, for control of the El Paso-Juarez corridor. And just like any war, any battle between two parties, there's going to be violence, death, and destruction until one side wins.
Monica, I agree with almost everything you said except the part of it's a fight against corruption. To where is the part of the fight against corruption in Calderon's war?
I would say corruption of organized crime into the federal government, which has allowed, that's what has allowed organized crime to go so far and make so much money, because there is definitely a system of corruption within government entities that facilitate the movement of illegal materials north.
Right, I agree with that. But I don't see. I think this is more of a rhetoric that the government uses fight against the corruption you're saying, because I haven't seen any results. I mean, we all know that the government system is infiltrated. Everybody knows it's almost like a secret in voices, secreto a voces. Everybody knows who's involved, and no big fish has fallen. Some police have been discharged or I don't know, maybe jail, but it's a few small fishes.
What I'm saying is these are the battles that were announced by the president. Now, I'm not saying whether or not there's been success,
right.
And there hasn't been on many fronts, but it is something. Corruption is among the things that the Calderon administration is supposed to be fighting. Has there been results? Not really. Not enough to satisfy the public or to convince the public that there are gains being made.
One of the real mysteries, at least for me, when I look at this, is like, who is doing the killing and why? I mean, from at least looking down from the United States. You know, for example, the 16 teenagers that were killed, that was about 3 weeks before the counselor killings. You know, I saw the mothers interviewed. Every mother comes forward and said, my children had nothing to do with drugs. But then you don't really know that, and you don't even know who actually did the killing. Or do you, Ma? Do we know more? Do we know anything more about those killings? Do we know anything more about the counselor killing, the three Americans who were killed? Why and who did it?
Well, no, no. It's in every situation. It's never. Nobody ever really knows who has done it, why, or who the people who were killed. What their lifestyle was. And this is in all cases in general. Specifically with the murders of the teenagers on January the 30th.
Now, this was absolutely shocking. It's a teenage party, and gunmen come in, and a drugs type hit, and they kill 16 kids.
15, actually.
15, okay.
There were 15 people killed in total. I believe two of them were adults, but the majority of them were teenagers. They were high school students.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them from a local football team. And yes, they're believed to be innocent students that were dedicated to nothing but their schoolwork, working, and they're believed to be generally good kids. And the mothers and families that I've spoken to, one mother in particular, I mean, she was saying how her son, the two of them would work together at a maquila. They would get up together, they would go to work, they would come back, he would go to school in the afternoon, and then they would come home. And that was his daily routine. And she says, how in between all that I would have known if my son was involved in any activity that would get him in trouble.
The problem, too, I think, Monica, and I don't know if you agree, is that really the government is not doing anything to investigate these killings.
I heard these statistics, Rebecca, that in 2009 there's 2,600 killings, 30 arrests. 30 arrests out of 2,600.
That has been a notorious problem for Mexico, and that has a lot to do with just basic police training, and that comes down just to gathering intelligence and just picking up clean evidence, just basic little things that the police need more training in.
Let me interrupt you for just 1 second just to tell people what we're doing here. This is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and today we're talking about what's behind the violence in Juarez and really throughout Mexico. And we're doing so with Monica Ortiz-Uribe, a reporter who works for NPR in El Paso, Juarez. And we're also very pleased to be joined by Rebecca Hasso Aguilar, whose doctoral work looks at contemporary political movements in Mexico. And what I'd like to do, because we're moving fast here, is really talk about the basic policy. Does the Calderon policy make sense? And let me just trot out a couple of arguments. The argument against the policy is, you know, that it's obviously not working. And the reason it's not working, the reason that a war on the drug cartels can't work, is basically it's a war on market economics. As long as you have a huge drug market in the United States where incredible profits. The DEA estimates that each cartel is making something like $12 billion a year. Well, with that kind of money at stake, a war on the cartels is never going to work. So that's the argument against what he's doing. The argument for what he's doing is that it sort of trails off on what Monica has already said, is that government corruption and integrity is already completely in question. If you back off now and the cartels win, they'll just grow more powerful, they'll grow stronger, they'll be more militarized, and it'll be ever tougher to root them out. They say, you know, just leave us alone, we want to sell drugs, but that's what every criminal says. And what criminals really want to do is corrupt the judiciary, corrupt the police, and allow themselves to make a lot of money, and you can't allow that to happen. So let me just start with you, Rebecca. Which side of the argument do you take?
Well, the thing is that a war, a military war, like Calderon is doing against the cartels, is not the only thing that could be done. I mean, why not attack the money laundering operations? You just mentioned how many billions?
12 billion.
Okay. Where is that money? It's in banks. It's cleaned. It's laundered. I mean, how come this cannot be pursued?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the U.S. looks strongly at drug laundering. This is my understanding. But I think one of the reasons the cartels vertically expanded was because they wanted to make sure they themselves could get the money back across the border and into their own hands.
That's still not an argument to attack them on a laundering operation.
That's right. And actually, there are a lot of people in Mexico benefiting from the influx of that money
into Mexico.
Well, both in Mexico
and in the United
States. And in the United States.
There's not only the people who sell and buy drugs benefit directly from this. I mean, there's the people who turn a blind eye to what's happening. There's lots of those. There's the big politician who might turn a blind eye too.
Mm-hmm. But what about the basic idea? I mean, do you just back off on the war? Do you say, look, this isn't working. Even if we try to balance out the cartels, that's not working. We should give up.
No, I don't think so. I think they should be looking at other strategies. I think attacking the corruption would be a better idea. I mean, not just in a rhetorical way, but actually doing something, not being afraid of punish those who are being related or who have been found to be related to the drug cartels. There is one person, his name is escaping my mind right now, Luna, García Luna.
García
Luna has been reportedly linked to illegal operations. I mean, there's ways to find out and to punish him. But he's,
even in the U.S., Rebecca, corruption is a very hard thing to root out. You need incredible investigative tools to effectively root out corruption.
I think that would be cheaper than all the money that it's being spent in this war.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me get your reaction, Monica. What do you think about the policy, and how would you assess it?
Well, I definitely don't think that it would be a good idea, and this is a conclusion I'm coming to, talking to the public, politicians, police, experts on both sides of the border, and I don't think the solution is to just allow the cartels to be and to allow them to conduct their business, because I mean, what it's still illegal, it's criminal activity, and there will always be rivalry between them, and thus there will always be violence. It will always produce violence, and I think the solution lies in strengthening Mexican law enforcement and the judicial system. Because like I had mentioned before, police have a long way to go in doing simple things like gathering evidence properly and gaining intelligence. And those elements are crucial to building a strong case in court. I mean, a lot of the reasons why we don't see crime solved is because there's not sufficient evidence to charge and convict people. And the public knows that, and they don't have any trust in institutions like the police or the judicial system. The other thing is comes down to social and economic infrastructure. I mean, Mexico has a huge problem with the unequal distribution of wealth.
Yeah, so I think like the most unequal distribution in Latin America.
That I'm not sure of. I just know that it's pretty. It's very,
it's
very
close.
It's no accident they have the richest men in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, Carlos.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. And I mean, in Juarez, you've got there's a whole history surrounding just the social problems that city is facing with now, and everybody dreaded the day that these issues would come to a head. And I think right now we're seeing these issues come up, and there are thousands and thousands of children there with both parents. They're working, and there are not enough schools in Juarez. There are not enough social activities for them to get involved in that would keep them away from organized crime.
Yeah, I mean, I read something that, you know, someone describes this as just feral children. I mean, you're talking about children who don't go to school, who don't do anything. And they did this survey, and 40% of young boys wanted to be drug hitmen. I mean, that's an astounding figure. But before I let you answer that, let me just mention that this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm very pleased to be talking with Monica Ortiz Uribe on the phone. You can hear her, among other things, on Latino USA. I'm also joined by Rebecca Hasso Aguilar, and Rebecca is a doctoral student here at UNM, and she's looking specifically at political movements in Mexico. And I guess, you know, one of the things I read was that what Calderon's really trying to do is balance the cartels. So he has sort of, it looks like he's sort of balancing on the side of Sinaloa, but in taking out after Juarez. But what he wants to do is restore some kind of balance. That's going to tamp down the violence. But what other people say is that's just corruption. You know, he's simply protecting the Sinaloa cartel, and that the corruption reaches all the way to the president of Mexico, and it's all politically motivated. And how do you see that, Rebecca?
Well, I think my personal opinion is that it's politically motivated, and it's not my own, but I think a lot of people in Mexico share this opinion. It was well known that when Vicente Fox was in the administration, he was also favoring this cartel, the same one that Calderon is favoring. And Calderon just went out on this war right after he...
And they're in the same party.
Yes, they are in the same party.
Right.
And if you remember the 2006 elections, they were very contended. And there were great allegations and actually proved allegations of fraud. And basically there is this feeling that he stole the elections.
Calderon
stole the elections. And everybody knew that he wanted... to legitimize himself, he needed to legitimize himself after having done this, after having become president in an illegitimate fashion. He needed to do something spectacular to legitimize himself, the same way Carlos Salinas did so in 1988 when he also became president after a fraud.
But Monica, what he's done, I mean, he's alienated the people and alienated the population, has he not? I mean, the Mexican population.
I find it's kind of mixed because when I talk to people whose loved ones have been murdered or they've been kidnapped or they've just suffered a terrible amount under the circumstances, I very often I ask them, well, despite everything you've lived through, you've gone through, what do you think about the president's initiative and his fight against organized crime? And I actually get pretty mixed answers, with people saying, you know what, I admire the president that he's willing to confront organized crime, and I hope it works out. I don't know how, but I hope it will. And then there are, of course, others who think that the strategy is totally off and it's not working, and they just wish things would go back to the way they were.
Let me skip to another point because we're really nearing we're nearing the end of the show, and I want to talk about what the U.S. policy ought to be toward Mexico and Mexican drug trafficking. And there's really an astounding fact to me, which is we have Juarez, which is the most dangerous city in the world by any way you want to calculate it, and then across the bridge we have El Paso, and El Paso. Juarez, well, what did you say, have 600 or 700 murders so far this year? El Paso has had one or two. El Paso is one of the safest cities in the United States. So, but despite that, there's been this reaction to the drug violence in Mexico. We've had Governor Richardson calling out the National Guard. We have Arizona passing this anti-immigrant, some would say racist, legislation. So, Monica, I'd like to start with you and say, you know, do you see evidence of this violence actually crossing the border, or is what's happening now in the U.S. really an overreaction to horrific violence in Juarez?
Okay, no, you don't see anything close to what's been occurring in Juarez here in El Paso, with two exceptions. Last year he was actually a government informant that was shot and killed in front of his house in just this pretty upper-class neighborhood on the east side of El Paso, and that was definitely a drug-related killing. Then there was also, a couple of months later, there was a man also involved in drug trafficking who was kidnapped from El Paso, taken to Juarez, and shortly after he was kidnapped, his body was found murdered. So there is, without a doubt, cartel and drug activity on this side of the border.
The U.S. side.
On the American side of the border.
Right.
But it's, I guess, what's the best way to describe it, I guess, is that they have to behave themselves on this side. They will get in trouble. They're more likely to get in trouble much quicker here. And it's so there is activity, but it's, of course, it's nowhere near the scale of what it is in Mexico. And there have been news reports that have said there's something like, I forget if like 200 or 300 cities that have a presence of Mexican drug cartels within them.
No, Monica, we're really nearing the end of the program. And there's something that really intrigues me, and that is, why do you do what you do? I think in the last several years, there have been 11 journalists killed covering the drug wars. The drug gangs and their cartels are very blatant. They warn journalists away. They threaten to kill them. And it's not just threats. They actually kill people. So why do you do what you do? Why do you risk your life doing what you do?
I mean, I'm glad you asked. I think about this. I've given this a lot of thought, especially since every time I'm going to cross the border to Juarez, my mother pleads with me not to go. And she says, "Why do you go? You have no need to go." And I really, that really got me to start thinking about why I go. And the reason is actually very simple. It's the people. The people in Juarez. We're neighbors. I can look out my window and see the Mexican flag waving in the wind. But the realities we live are completely different. We live in two different worlds. And I feel when I go and talk with them and I hear their stories and I hear just how they live with incredible pain and violence and overall injustice, that not only are they victims of crimes, but they never see those crimes get solved, and they have to live with that. I feel it's very important to hear their stories and then come back here to the U.S. where we have a much greater degree of confidence and trust in our law enforcement and judicial systems, to share that and say, look, these are our neighbors. And this is a shared problem between Mexico and the U.S., and we should, the least we can do is pay attention. And another thing I would add is when I talk to people in Juarez and you see the desperate situations that they're in and you think, my gosh, how could I mean, if that were happening to me, I don't know how I would go on. I don't know how I could continue with my life. But they do. They find a way, and they have this incredible resilience and strength that I am absolutely, I admire 100%. And I think it's for that reason once I've heard those stories, I can't just stop going. I feel an obligation and a responsibility to go as often as is necessary.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I would like to thank my two guests, Monica Ortiz Uribe and Rebecca Hasso Aguilar. Thanks also to my producer, John Burgund. My name is Stephen Spitz, and you've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM Community Powered Radio. Podcasts of this and other locally produced shows can be found at KUNM.org.